You're listening to episode 8 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order. This is a technical podcast about Linux and GNU and Unix and BSD programming and all kinds of fun computer-related things. And don't worry if you're new to all of that. You can just go back and listen to, season 2. Up until this point, you'll be all caught up. So, it'll only take you, like, 3 days if you listen nonstop. So, in this program, very episode, we're going to talk about object-oriented programming with Python, how to create classes and methods and functions and selfs and inits and things like that. And we're also going to talk about Sphinx, which is a great, great documentation method that I just found out about and I'm really excited about and wanted to talk about last week really, really badly, but could not for want of time. So let's get started now. I'm sure I probably got a lot of listener feedback between the time of the last episode and this episode, or the previous episode and this episode, but I wouldn't know because I'm actually recording this the same night that I recorded the previous episode, which is cheating, and I don't like to do that because it feels less authentic and real time and, you know, of the moment. But again, like I told you last episode, I am moving out of the country very, very soon, so I'm trying to establish a little bit of a backlog of episodes for myself so that I don't miss any release dates, which I still cannot guarantee I won't miss them, but here's the effort. So the first thing I want to talk about is Sphinx. And Sphinx is, as I gave you a teaser last episode, Sphinx is this documentation framework, I guess you could call it, which enables you to write your documentation or your text in any way. I mean, it doesn't have to be documentation. Obviously, it can be anything. It could be a fiction book. It could be a collection of poetry. It could be anything. And you can write this text and then process it with Sphinx and end up with like a web page of all of your stuff and a PDF and an EPUB and a plain text, I think, all from the same source. So it's kind of that mythical write once, export everywhere. And it's really nice. And what makes it nice, I think, is, well, there are two things. One thing that makes it ostensibly nice is that the markup that you have to learn for Sphinx is very, very simple. And I say it's simple, I guess, compared to XML, although that doesn't really seem all that simple to me. So I guess I just mean it's simple in that you don't really have to get a whole lot of, I guess, logic and you don't have to feel like you're learning something new. I personally like XML a lot. It seems very, flexible and yet well-defined. And that's a really hard balance to strike, I think. And XML manages to do that. So in DocBook, the ability to say, yes, this is going to be a paragraph. And within this paragraph, this is going to be something else. And all these very obvious kind of like blocks of delimiters. I like that. Sphinx doesn't use that so much. It does a lot with, hey, you want a paragraph? Press return twice. You're in a new paragraph. And it uses underlines and asterisks around the words to highlight or emphasize rather, and two asterisks to emphasize and bold, strong, whatever they call it. Oblique, I don't know. It feels maybe a little bit more familiar to people. And it looks a little bit less, it definitely looks less intrusive. So when you open up an XML document, even a well-structured, like pretty printed XML document that someone did with like in XML mode in Emacs, keeps it all nice and neat for you, it's still pretty tough to read sometimes. I mean, you have to kind of get over the fact that there are all these XML tags getting in your way. So the markup in a Sphinx document, which is it's restructured text is what it's called. REST. Restructured text. So it kind of looks like ASCII art that, or I mean, it looks like normal text with a little bit of ASCII art sprinkled in for emphasis. You know, so you've got like the chapter heading or the chapter title would be underlined with equal signs. You know, it's like a double underline. Your section heading would be text with a single underline under it, or dashes rather. So it almost looks like you were just doing it sort of because you didn't know how to use a word processor, so you were just trying to make your plain text document look a little bit fancier. But as it turns out, and I mean, that is intuitive, right? I mean, you can kind of see the logic really fast. Chapter one, you want it to be chapter one? Well, give it two underlines. That seems important. You want it to be section one of chapter one? Give it one underline. That seems almost as important. You know, so there's like this sort of intuitive logic to it, I think, once you kind of see where it's going. So that's one nice thing about it, or it could be a nice thing if you're not into XML. And even being into XML, I didn't mind the simpler markup all that much. I found it pretty quick to learn. You know, you leave sphinx-doc.org on a web page on one screen, and you type on the other screen, and when you need to figure out, how do I make something emphasized again? Flip back, look it up really quick, flip back, make it, and then you remember it. So, really kind of easy to learn. That's one thing. The other thing is the fact that Sphinx kind of just works. You install Sphinx, at least on a Linux box, and you do a Sphinx quick start. It creates the skeletal structure of your project for you. You start making your table of contents and start creating the pages to which you refer, and you're done. And then you do a Sphinx or make HTML. You've just made a web page. Make EPUB. You've just made an EPUB. Make LaTeX PDF. You've just made a PDF. It's nice. And I say that from the standpoint of someone who has sat down with DocBook and gone through a billion different XML errors, debugged all that stuff, and then gone through a billion XML and XSL problems and tweaking the XSL style sheet or trying to figure out where exactly the EPUB XSL process dumps you out and realizing that XSLT proc is actually just a little bit farther along in its EPUB processing than XML2, so let's switch to that this time, and that gives us an EPUB, and now let's switch over to FOP for PDF. I mean, it can get painful. It really, really can. I mean, once you develop it, once you've put it all together, then it can be easy and pretty transparent to you. But you're the guy putting all that stuff in place. And that might be fun. Might not be fun. It might be fun for some projects and less fun for others. You know, that's kind of where I see Sphinx right now. Is, you know, if DocBook is to LibreOffice as Sphinx is to Kwrite, if you get my meaning. You know, if you just want to jot something down really quickly and get the thing produced, and get a pretty printed out, pretty print version of HTML, EPUB, and PDF, because you need to get a syllabus to, you know, the dean of your school, because you're a teacher now in my scenario, quickly, then Sphinx might be the way to do that. It might be a lot faster and easier than struggling with DocBook if you don't have DocBook already kind of set up and configured and your whole tool chain designed. So I was really, really impressed with Sphinx, just kind of for how quickly I was able to learn it. And I didn't really expect myself to be able to learn it quite as quickly as I learned it, but it really is a really, really simple little system. And it's kind of beautiful in a really sort of simple kind of way. You can actually look at all of the Sphinx source code the Sphinx source code for my programming book that I'm using for this series of programming tutorials that we have hereby embarked upon together. It is at gitorius.org/programmingbook. And you can look at all the source code there. I'm going to kind of go over some of it. You don't have to look at it, but I'm going to go over some of it anyway. And the way that that I did this was I ported it all from DocBook. So there are some things that are probably a little bit more DocBookian than a dyed-in-the-wool Sphinx user might have things structured. Either way, the initial document of your Sphinx project, well, the first thing that you would do is you would open up a terminal and type in Sphinx Quick Start. And Sphinx-Quick Start will simply establish the skeleton structure of a Sphinx project in whatever current directory you're working in. And it's interactive. It asks you for the title of your work and things like that. And it plugs a lot of that stuff into one of the default files that it creates for you called conf.py. So conf.py is something good to look at. We won't go over it right now because, as I told Ken Fallon, and as I maintain, I don't like getting into the nitty-gritty details until we have proofs of concepts already done. That was a little jab at Ken Fallon, one of those elbow jabs. Yeah, so there's the conf.py really is quite nice to look at because it does have some handy little things, just little touches here and there that you can kind of play around with and use to customize your project so that it doesn't look exactly like every other Sphinx project out there. So the first file that you would create then yourself would be index. It seems that RST is a pretty popular extension for these files. Technically speaking, you can actually use pretty much any extension you want, but RST sounds like it's good enough, you know, REST, RST. So index.rst would be ideally at least your chapter, your table of contents. Now, I also made it in my sort of DocBookian tradition. I made it the first, like the, what do they call it, the book info portion of the document. So I have it being a programming book at the very top of the document with double underlines. So that's just go down to the next line and do equals, you know, so that you're kind of underlining the length of the title. And then I did sort of like an edition and the authors with their email addresses and legal notice where I license it GNU FDL and an abstract and finally contents. So the table of contents in Sphinx is like a zinclude on DocBook, which if you don't really use DocBook, and even in DocBook you don't necessarily have to do it that way. But the way that I was taught DocBook by my very good friend Bill von Hagen was that you create sort of like this master list of all the chapter documents that are going to go into your larger DocBook document. So it's kind of like the almost like a make file or something. It lists everything that's going to be then, you know, put into this one larger document. And that's basically what the table of contents in Sphinx is. So I gave it a contents and then a single underline, so that's just the dashes under contents. And then the convention in Sphinx of kind of, I guess what I would think of as an opening tag in XML would be dot dot space and then some keyword and then double colon. So in this case it would be dot dot space TOC tree, that's table of contents tree, colon, colon. And then you can list all of the document titles that are to be included in your final build. So in this case, I have intro, Linux, apps, bash, dice, Rolodex, Rolodim, Rolodux, object, Python, Pygame, platformer, animation, and so on. Now you'll notice that I'm not giving the extensions. You are not supposed to give extensions here. Don't put .rst. It doesn't need that. It doesn't want that. It chops off the extensions for you, which is why you can actually use any extension you want. .txt, .rst, you know, whatever you feel like. You also have to keep in mind that since this is all Python based, indentation matters. That's really, really important. It's important whether you like it or not. I have to admit, I don't love it. I really think I would rather deal with XML most days than have to deal with the indentation subtleties of all of these, you know, Sphinx different layers and different clauses and scopes, and just figuring out how far you have to indent stuff over, and was it indented correctly, and is it wrapping correctly, just really, really has been kind of annoying for me, to be honest. There's something really nice in Emacs. If you're using Emacs for your documentation, then there's this one-liner that you can put into your .emacs file, which, again, my friend Bill von Hagen actually told me about. It's paren set q-default space indent-tabs-mode space nil close paren. And what that does is it tells Emacs not to use tabs. Emacs by default inserts actual tabs when you hit tab. So what this does is tell it to actually just go ahead and use spaces instead. That seems to have helped a lot. I still get confused. It gets complex. Whatever. So dot dot space talk tree colon colon, and then an indented list of all the files that are supposed to go into your table of contents. Depending on how many sections and subsections and subsections you have in each chapter, you may want your chapter, your table of contents, to either list, you know, all of those sections and subsections and subsections and subsections, or you may just want it to go down maybe two levels and just list that. Turns out there's a little tag for that in Sphinx. And the way that you do tags in Sphinx are, again, they're indented to the same level as your chapter listings are. And they're wrapped in colons. So it's dot dot space talk tree colon colon next line tabbed in once. For instance, colon max depth colon space 2. So that's telling it, obviously, only list down the two section, you know, a chapter and a section, chapter and a section. Don't go into subsections. I could make it go into subsections by making it max depth 3 or 4 or whatever, but I'm doing 2. And then the next line I did a single tab over, and I did colon numbered colon. So that means that it's going to number these chapters for me. I don't need to number them myself. It will take care of that for me. It's quite a nice feature. And that's your table of contents. So that essentially is your master file from which, when you're compiling your book, that's what Sphinx is going to look to figure out what to compile in to your final work. Then what you do is, alongside of index.rst, you start building the files, just kind of almost Wikipedia style, you know? I mean, you kind of establish, okay, this file exists. I mean, you could do it the other way around too, but this is kind of how I envision doing it. Establish, okay, I've got a chapter here called intro, and then you make a file called intro.rst. And then in intro.rst, you would give it a chapter heading. So, for instance, in this source, it's literally, who should read this book? And then under that, I give it the double underline, so that's the equal sign, all the way across. And then I just start typing. You just start typing, just normal kind of typing. Just start typing. No tags, no markup, just type. When you reach the end of a paragraph, hit return twice, start your next paragraph. Simple as that. And again, things like italics. You just surround the word or the group of words in asterisk. Or bold italics, double asterisks. What else? The links. You've got code. Little monospace words you can surround in tick marks. That's the key, right? To the left of the one on an American keyboard. I think they're called ticks. I don't know. They're like apostrophes, but backwards. Tick marks. And, code blocks. So code blocks, you would think, in something that that is really largely designed for coding documentation, you'd almost, at least I would actually have thought that the coding would have been a little bit easier to make happen. I have had a lot of trouble with my code blocks. I think it was because I wasn't doing the indents correctly, and by that I mean I didn't have that magical indent thing turned off in my .emacs file, so I was actually really making tabs when I guess I should have made spaces. Either that or, I mean, I am porting this from DocBook, so I did a bunch of conversions, so it might have gotten things kind of screwed up in there. But the way that you do it anyway is that, for instance, if you're typing, here's a random place. So look for this block of code for reference, colon, colon, next line, indent once, and then insert your code. And then just like an if loop in Python or any other thing in Python, really, you don't really close it. You just hit return twice and start typing again back at your original indent place. So you lose a level of indention. And then now it knows that you're out of the code block. Again, a Python aware, and better yet, a REST aware text editor is I would imagine pretty much a must. I can't imagine trying to do this without color cues and automatic indenting and stuff like that. I cannot fathom trying to do that. But it is. You know, I mean, it's simple, and the danger with simplicity, I guess, is always that maybe it's a little bit too simple sometimes, which I would definitely say, yeah, that's something that I have to deal with here. But then again, you know, you can go complex like DocBook, and then you have to deal with, like, the complexity that you've got, which might be fun, might not be fun. It just kind of depends on what mood you're in and what kind of time crunch you're under. Let's see, what else? Well, there are notes and warnings and tips. And again, that stuff is just the dot dot space note colon colon, and then you start typing, or dot dot space warning colon colon, or dot dot space tip colon colon. So those will give the little call outs, you know, those little kind of highlighted areas that say, you know, warning, do not type in this command or else you will ruin your entire computer or whatever. So that is that's how you do a REST document for Sphinx. It's really, really basic. I mean, I've literally told you, like, really kind of, like, the important, the must-know kinds of things. That was it. That was how you do it. When you're ready to build, it's a simple makefile. The makefile already exists for you, so you could modify it if you want. Don't necessarily have to. I have not actually modified it at all yet. I haven't felt the need to. But you can do a make HTML, which you can type in make and you'll see all the different options that you have. So you can do make HTML, and that'll do a standalone HTML group of files in a web structure. So you upload that to your website, or your web server rather, and you direct people to the HTML directory, and yes, they will see your site. There's a dir HTML, which makes HTML files all named index.html in directories appropriate to the chapter title. I have not tried that yet. It sounds like a brilliant idea. I probably should have done it. I didn't. Single HTML makes this a big, huge single HTML file. I have no interest in that. A bunch of other stuff. And then the I think a killer feature is EPUB. It does EPUBs just like that. And then there's also LaTeX PDF, which it does just like that. And if you've ever had to deal with Apache FOP, and all the things that go into generating PDFs, this is I would say that this was less painful to me than any other PDF generation I have ever done. So, congratulations to Sphinx for having that distinct honor. There are more. That's just a brief overview. There is more to it than that. But the key here is, I think, that if you dedicate maybe an afternoon to learning this thing, you will be amazed at how quickly you pick it up. You will learn all of the markup, such as it is, in no time whatsoever, especially if you just keep, like I say, keep the sphinx-doc.org site open. It's got great links to, like, intros to REST or restructured text, just keep it open as a reference. You'll learn it so quickly. It's amazing. And then I gave myself, you know, I finished up the porting of the DocBook source for this one book over to Sphinx, and I thought, okay, it's really late at night, I should go to bed, and I'll get up in the morning and take the rest of the day to learn the exporting part of Sphinx. I did that, except the last part, so I get up the next day, start messing around with the, you know, how to build this stuff into an EPUB and a PDF into an HTML, and it must have literally, maybe it took me 15 minutes max. I mean, I was amazed. It just produced all three export targets so quickly and so easily. It was a little bit embarrassing. I couldn't believe it. I think I did have a couple of errors here and there, but they were file path errors or something like that. And you know, I had to deal with that, but it was not a big deal at all. It was really, really easy. It was shockingly easy. It was a pleasure. It was really, really nice. So if you are looking for a quick, you know, markup style of documentation, this may be something to look at, especially if you're ever in the position, mark my words on this, if you're ever in the position where you are like at a job or something, or you're volunteering to help out on an open source project or whatever, and they think that you should be doing documentation, the last thing in the world you want to do is turn to something that you know, like LibreOffice or whatever. You do not want to do your documentation in a word processor. I guarantee it. It might be comfortable for you. You might feel at home in a word processor. I don't, so I never even had to battle that impulse. I don't use word processors. I never really have. But if you do feel comfortable in a word processor and you think, well, I'm writing text, I might as well do that, and I can drag in images and it'll look just like a manual, it will. You're right. It'll look great. It'll look fantastic. It will not be maintainable. Trust me. Trust me. I know. You can turn on changes and track all that stuff. Trust me, you don't want to do it that way. I've seen it done multiple times. It has been ugly. It has been horrible. I mean, ugly in the sense that going back and maintaining it is just so horrible. You don't want to do it. So learn Sphinx at the very least, and you will be amazed at how quickly you learn it, at how good it looks, at how easy it is to export to multiple different formats. And of course, version control is easy because you've got Git. So you can use Git to do this. It's brilliant. Try it. You will love it. As I said, you can see examples on gatorius.org/programmingbook. It may not be the best example ever. You know, you could also just look at the source code for the Python documentation, I imagine. But mine is also in Sphinx now, at least Programming Book is. So you can look at that, get a feel for how it's done, and then just go with it. Run with it. Learn it. You'll love it. It's very, very cool. Okay, now we're going to program. And if we're going to program, I think you'll agree, we probably should have some coffee close at hand. So let's go get ourselves a cup and come back and do some object-oriented programming. Let's overview what we've already learned. We've learned Bash together, and I have to admit that the Bash lesson that I did in this little programming series was not great. I mean, it was fine, but I mean it wasn't super extensive. And I feel I did that because I feel like I've covered enough Bash on this show that kind of glossing over Bash in general would be okay at this point. Because we've been there, we've done that. And like I pointed out in the last episode, if you really want more Bash experience, by all means, go to straightedgelinux.com/blog/python.html and look at the programming book, which is what I'm using from, you know, for all these tutorials, and look at like the first about chapter 4 until chapter 9. Is all Bash. So it'll give you a great intro to Bash, and it goes through a lot of different things. The basics, parsing, getting input, providing output, parsing, or I said parsing, but I sort of get opts, that kind of thing, like with options and arguments. So you'll get plenty of that there. But now I feel like we've transitioned into Python, because I feel like probably most of the listeners, that's you guys, are probably on the Python level. And if I'm wrong, let me know. I don't know what I can do about it, but that's where I think we are. All right, so I'm deviating from the source material here a little bit, but that's nothing new. I'm just kind of using this as a general guide. But roughly where we will be right now is in chapter, I guess, 12 or so. But bear with me, because I really want to... I feel like I want to talk a little bit about object-oriented programming, especially in light of some of the feedback that I got about how confusing it supposedly was that I used Bash initially to kind of suggest to people what object-oriented programming was. And I said towards that feedback that I do not apologize for doing so, and I still don't apologize for doing so. I still think it was a great idea. And in this episode, you're going to see why. Because, as we know, in the previous episode, like that's 907 or whatever, we did a scripted version of the dice game in Python, meaning that it had the shebang, it did an import of random, it took a player and a computer and assigned them each their own unique random number from 0 to 6, and then we compared the two values, and if you won, then the computer says you win, and if you lose, it calls you a loser, and then it quits either way. And that's how the program ran. And when you look at that, and when you hit, you know, when you open a terminal and tell, okay, dice, you know, run your program, you can kind of see, or you can imagine, that you can see what the computer is doing. And it starts at the top, and it goes through the program line by line, and processes each possibility, if this, then that. And then it ends, and that's it. That's the program. It's very easy to follow. And, of course, that's why they call it scripting, right? I mean, it is on script. It stays to this script. It's line by line, do this, and then do that, and then do this clause, line by line, and then drop back down and start doing this. And it's very, I guess, linear. And then we did the Bash dice game, where we wrapped all of the dice stuff in a function, and as Ken and Jonathan told me, this could be perhaps called a procedural or functional programming, wherein when you open the source code and you look at it, you know, the line number that you would read first does not necessarily correspond with the first action that the computer is going to take. And that's very true. The whole dice function that we created in the Bash quote-unquote object-oriented like version of dice, that whole function that we wrapped that stuff in, that didn't get executed until Bash, you know, kind of got down to line, like, I don't know, 12, and then it saw the command, okay, dice, and then it called that function. And then we were actually in, you know, the meat of the program. Well, object-oriented stuff goes even farther, and this becomes... This can get complex, so we're going to do a super simple version of our little dice game, which will be in Python, and it's going to create an object. And the object is going to be a virtual dice. And as we've already discussed, a dice in real life can be really a couple of things, and they're frequently six-sided, but as any true nerd knows, the really good ones are like 21-sided dice. You know why. You know what I'm talking about. Talking to you. So our dice, our virtual dice is gonna just be a die without really knowing how many sides it is until we, the programmer, tell it. Now, we could make that really fancy and actually when we execute the script, you know, have the player tell it, okay, I'm gonna play dice, and I'm going to pass 21 through my argument, through the line command argument, and that's going to get read into my program. But we're not going to do it that way. We could, though. It would be really easy to do that. And I don't know. Maybe if we have time at the end, we'll take it that far. Or maybe that's your homework. I don't know. So the first thing that we'll do is we'll do the shebang. That's the first line. So shebang /usr/bin/env space Python. And you'll recall from the last episode that we use env because that gives preference to the user's environment. It's debatable whether that's better or just something to do, but that's the habit I've gotten into, so that's what we're going to do. Then the next line, of course, will be our import line. This is a simple dice game. I don't think we're going to need much, so we'll just import random again. You remember random. That's the thing that gave us the ability to just quickly and easily have Python return some number within a certain range. Okay, so first thing we'll do is we'll create this class called dice. So the way to do that is you type in the word class, and then you do a space, and then dice, paren paren, colon. Okay, you've just opened up a class block, or a class block. So that means that everything from here on needs to be indented once, at least once. No, I shouldn't say at least. It should be indented once to fall within this class. Okay, within this class, we are going to create an init statement. The init function in a class is something that is going to run whenever we call the dice class later on in the program. So if we're writing out our program, which we will, we're at some point going to want to use a dice. We're going to have to call our class, hey, give me a dice, give me my virtual dice now. Well, when we do that, it's going to run the thing that it's going to do is it's going to perform this init function that we're writing right now. So the way that we do that is we're in class, so we know that we have to indent once. So we indent once, and then we use the word def, as in define, def space, and then traditionally it's underscore underscore init underscore underscore paren self close paren. We'll come back to that in a minute, actually, because that's not really all we want, but there you go. That's a very basic init state. Oh, colon. Did I say colon? So def space underscore underscore init underscore underscore paren self close paren colon. That now we've created a function inside of the class. So anything inside of this function needs to be indented twice, right? Because once for the class, once for the function. All right. So the first thing that we'll do is we will create a player and a computer value, just as we did in the bash and just as we did in the scripted Python version. That's the thing that we want to do. When we create this die that we want to use, we want it to just go ahead and roll for us. You know, give us two numbers, assign one number to player, one number to computer, and that's what we want to know. So our first statement within our function, so that's twice indented now, indent, indent, self.player equals random.randrange paren 6, close paren. 6 because I'm saying 6-sided die. If you want yours to be a 21-sided die, then say 21 there. It doesn't really matter. And then the next line would be, again, indent, indent, self.computer equals random.randrange paren 6 paren. Again, 6-sided die for me. So, and I'm doing 6 because that increases the likelihood of winning, basically. If you do 21, I guess, in my mind, the likelihood, and I'm not a probabilities guy, you can argue with me on this, but in my mind, it would be less likely that you win, so then you wouldn't get to see the winning results of your game until a lot later. So that's why I'm using 6. Okay, so there you go. That's our initialization sequence of whenever we call upon our dice class, it is going to run this init sequence, thereby essentially rolling. That's what it's doing, right? All right, that's not the only thing we want it to do. So we can add further function to this class by adding another, well, function. And the one that we'll call it here is we'll call it compare. So now we're still in the class, but we're doing a new function. So we only indent once now. So indent def space compare paren self paren colon. So the reason we're doing this whole self thing is because the functions need to be able to share information between themselves. And in order to do that, they need to sort of latch onto an instance. And traditionally, the instance of all the data that we're creating here is just called self. So we want to require self when we do a comparison, because otherwise we wouldn't have anything to compare. I don't know if that makes sense yet, but if you've ever had any dealings with like local variables or something that you, where you, you know, you can use something as long as you're in this portion of your code, or you can use this on this web page, but not on another one. I mean, heck, even like, if you're doing HTML, you know, you might be able to say, I'm in an HTML document, so use the style sheet that is in this current directory. But if you create a new directory and put a new web page in that directory, and you say use stylesheet.css, that wouldn't work, right? You have to say use .../stylesheet.css, because stylesheet.css isn't in your current directory. So that's kind of what this is. The functions within this class aren't going to have access to all the information unless you kind of pass the information back and forth between them. And that's kind of the function of this self entity. So we're saying indent def space compare paren self close paren colon. And the compare, I'm naming it that. You could call it look. You could call it check. You could call it anything. We're making it up. We're writing this code ourselves. So def space compare paren self close paren colon. So now we're in this function, so we need to do two indents. So we'll do indent indent, and we'll do the same comparison that we did in the other Python, the scripted version. In fact, it's basically exactly the same with one small change, and that is if space, instead of saying if space player equals equals computer colon, we're saying if space self dot player space equals equals self dot computer colon. So again, we're saying this is the attribute player of the class that we have now created. It's not just some global random variable that we need. It's the self variable. It's the variable that we're creating within this class. So then we go down to the next line for the results. So if self.player equals equals self.computer colon indent indent indent, that's three indents, print paren quote you win quote paren return indent 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 quit paren paren, and then the next line is just two indents again, so that's flush with the if, indent indent else colon. Next line, indent, 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 that's three indents again, print, paren, quote, you lose, quote, paren, and then the next line, indent, 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 quit, paren, paren, and now we're out of our class. So, our class, our dice right now, and we're going to improve this, but right now, as of this moment, our dice is a six-sided dice, hard-coded six-sided. And what it does is if we decide to use a dice in our program, it initializes the dice by giving a player value and a computer value, and then it compares and then optionally, if we use the compare function of this class, it will compare those two values and tell us whether we won or lost. Okay? So, that means that the next line, no indenting now, we're very clear of our class. We're in our actual program at this point. We could say, my dice, which I stole from Ken, my dice equals dice paren paren, and then my dice dot compare paren paren. So you see what we're really doing there? We're saying my dice equals dice, paren, which runs which function? The init function. And then the next line we say mydice.compare. So we're using our own class that we've, you know, we're using the instance of our own class, mydice, and we're saying within that class dot use the compare function. That's why we are saying mydice.compare paren. Pretty cool, huh? So if you run that, if you save that and make it executable and then run it in a terminal, you should see, you know, either you win or you lose, and that should work, and it does. It's working for me. So now let's go back and improve it a little bit. So part of the reason that we're doing object-oriented stuff is because it adds a lot of flexibility and, you know, lets you kind of be more productive with your code. I mean, it does a lot more if we have a more complex program. This is pretty simple either way, but definitely we can make this a little bit more interesting for ourselves. And this is a good example of exactly how classes work and kind of how data gets passed back and forth between all of the different components. So now what we'll do is go back up to the top to line 6 or so, where you have def space init, def space underscore underscore init underscore underscore paren self paren colon. Well, instead of just taking self, let's include the number of sides. But we're not going to hard code that in. We're going to say comma sides. So we've got now indent def space underscore underscore init underscore underscore paren self comma sides close paren colon. Okay, now we need to abstract the number of sides away from our player. So we've got self.player equals random.randrange paren 6. Let's just type in sides instead of the number 6. And the same thing for the computer. Okay, so obviously we're using a variable, which by the way doesn't actually exist yet. We're using a variable called sides, and that's going to define for us, more or less on the fly, how many sides that dice will actually have. For friendlier gameplay, let's add two lines in the init statement as well, where we're actually printing paren self.player, close paren, and print paren self.computer, close paren. And I think that'll do it, I think. So now, down at the bottom of your code, where you say my dice equals dice paren, we need to give it a little bit more information. So, what we'll do is we will feed it a sides variable, and that's where you can determine how many number of sides you want in your dice. So you can say sides equals, for instance, 21. And now my dice equals dice paren sides paren. And my dice dot compare paren. Okay? So all we've done there is we've established a variable called sides, and we've given it a number. And then when we are calling our object, we are sure to take that variable and wrap it up in those parens. So we got my dice equals dice paren sides, close paren. That calls class, our class dice. And when it runs the initialization sequence, or whatever you call that, the function, init function, it not only feeds itself in like its own data, but it also feeds in the sides data that we sent along with it. That's quite nice. So now, if we run this program, we not only see the number of, you know, the results of our dice roll, but we also get our either you win or you lose message. Oh, there was a win, 4 and 4. But we are also we know that we're also defining the number of sides on the dice in our code. Now, as I mentioned before, we even started there, it would be probably even more interesting if we took this a little bit farther and said, well, let's let the user decide how many dice there are. Now, for that, we need to get something from the user on the command line, yeah? And that's not so hard. And in fact, as I mentioned, I think in the previous episode, there's a There's a lesson on that on straightedgelinux.com/blog/python.html. It's the sysarg lesson. So what you have to do for that is you have to import sys. So right under random, you can do import sys. And then you can pretty much just say that in your sides argument, instead of saying like sides equals 6 or sides equals 21 or something like that, you can say instead sides equals sys.argv, that's argvictor, argv, square bracket 1, square bracket. Now that's not going to work. I'm just warning you now. But it's going to be very close, and then we're going to go back and fix it. So if you save that and run your program again, it gives you an error. It says, well, it gives you a bunch of errors, and it boils down to this: value error, non-integer arg1 for rand range. Okay, so what that means is that Python is seeing, like, the number 3, like when I typed in /dice.py/3, then it sees that number. It sees that as a text, a letter, a character is what I'm trying to say, rather than an integer. And random needs an integer. It wants numbers, not just characters. So this is, kind of like type casting, I guess, in Python, or maybe not kind of, maybe it's exactly. But the point is that we have to run the system argument, like that argument that the person has passed to dice.py, through some kind of conversion process. It would be akin to running, echo, quote, hello, close quote, pipe, tr, upper, lower, or lower, upper, rather. It would filter the letters through tr to transfer all the lowercase to uppercase. We need something like that, except in this case, we don't need upper and lowercase, we need a character to become an integer. So that would be, we can modify, I think it should be around line 20 or so, sides equals int, int, paren, sys.argv, square bracket 1, close square bracket, close paren. So there we've got a variable called sides, and it's going to be equal to the result of integer, of the integer function in Python, integer, and what we pass to integer is the system argument, the first argument on the command line, and then we close all that stuff out. So save that, and then go back into your command line, or your terminal rather, do a /dice.py, and let's just do a number 2. And there's 2, and I got 1 and a 0, and I lost. There's 1 and 0 again, and there's 1, 1, and I win. So there you go. So now the player themselves can decide how many sides their dice actually has when they're rolling. Now in this case, you would probably also want to make some kind of parsing thing so that if they hit /dice.py and didn't give it an argument, then it would either still play, or it would, it would take a default value, or maybe it would give them some kind of helpful message like, hi, I noticed that you didn't give me a number of sides that you want your dice to be. Dice.py requires a number of sides, i.e. dice.py /21. Whatever. So, you would probably want to make this a little bit more user-friendly, but I think you get the idea. So I want to review all this because, again, I think object-oriented is horribly confusing at first. And the thing to remember, I guess, is that when you're defining a class, when you're creating a class, that's the object to which most people refer, I guess. And so we're saying class, in this case, dice, paren, paren, colon, whatever. And then within that class, there are usually functions. And these functions, like the init function, is going to run whenever you call that object. That's just how it works. And you usually want to pass in self to that. That usually takes, itself, essentially, its own data wants to be accessible to that thing. I don't know that I've seen one that doesn't have self. I'm sure, maybe, but usually you want self at least. Now, you may want some other data, but if you put other data up there, like we did, self, comma, sides, then sides at some point has to exist, or else Python won't be able to process the init statement. It's going to tell you, hey, I wanted two arguments, and you gave me a total of one, and so it doesn't know what to do. So that's what happens there, and then you can add additional functions, which you can call by referencing, you know, your instance of that class dot name of your function. So mydice.compare, whatever. And it's exactly, I mean, beyond the fact that there's this kind of object, it's a lot like the object-oriented version of the dice that we did in Bash, which was not object-oriented, but it felt like it. And the reason it felt like it was because you had these, you know, you had this function which was self-contained and that you could call upon, and it would run its little code sort of as a self-contained entity and then, you know, cause different things to happen. So in this case, you're simply, you're kind of grouping those functions together within this class object. And then to make things really cool, you can feed data in and out of that class object, with like these additional arguments that you're issuing. So again, this code, will be in the source material, and, look for it. It's a good one. It explains a lot, I think. And, I think that's probably the lesson for today. Hopefully it was very, very useful. I think it's, I mean, if you don't get it, don't worry. We're gonna do more, object-oriented stuff, and maybe it'll start to click. Definitely it starts to click the more you do it. I think I said that last time. It's kind of common sense, but it never hurts to hear it. You know, the more you practice with this stuff, the more it starts to make sense, because a lot of this doesn't, like, inherently make sense. It just makes sense because you've done it 20 times before. So the old adage that practice makes perfect is, yes, it's still true, and I encourage you to do that. Practice with Python, and soon you will start to get some of these things kind of instilled within you. And there are a lot of really interesting things that you can learn from this simple example, from this dice.py or whatever you called it example. For instance, you can, and if you look at the source material for this in the show notes, you'll see a lot of this done, you know, in writing as well. You can read over it, but you could do it yourself. You know, see what happens if you remove the self thing, for the self argument from the functions. Or maybe you don't call it self. Maybe you call it something else, like this, or whatever. Just, you know, play around. See what's a requirement. What things are doing. What breaks when you change something. That can be awfully enlightening as well. So hopefully this has helped. Please go practice, and I will talk to you in about 2 weeks or so. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
New Zealand.